I left, well, I did my O-levels in 1977, so that's ancient history. I went to secondary school in 1972. So between those 5 years, I got to see quite a lot of different teachers. And it's quite clear, you quite quickly realize which teachers have authority. People will do what they're told by that teacher, and which teachers don't. Usually it's the PE teachers are amongst that group who seem to have that natural authority. I'm not sure it's something to do with the fact, well, in those days they wielded the cane or the canoe paddle, whatever implement it was they used to chastise us. In those days, back in those barbaric days of 1972, they still had corporal punishment. I'm sure it was character building. But you see, and there was also one teacher I particularly remember who wasn't a PE teacher, you know, a sports teacher. He was a maths teacher. His name was George Saunders. He's indelibly printed on my mind, individual. Wasn't very shouty, but he just had that natural authority and respect. And I don't know what it was, but there was something about him that no one messed around in his class. Even the most badly behaved person of that particular year group, they, for whatever reason, he had that authority. Similarly, you know the teachers which haven't got a hope. They have no control, no authority in their class. I can remember one, this is probably about 1973, and a lady, and she came in, and the first, she was new, and she said she wanted to be called Ms., not Miss or Mrs. And I'm not making any comment about feminism or the use of Ms., but in those days, back in 1973, it was something of a new concept to us. And I'm afraid from that point on, she lost all authority because everybody went around going Ms. all through her lessons. And not surprisingly, she didn't last very long at that particular school. But it is, you know, authority and control. And the reason I mention my anecdotes from ancient history back in the early 70s when I was at school is because in this passage here, we are looking at Jesus and what he has, what he will do in terms of miracles, and particularly healing miracles. As I just, as I mentioned earlier, the previous chapters, 5 to 7, often referred to as the Beatitudes or the Sermon on the Mount, the crowds were taken by the authority Jesus had in his teaching. And now, Matthew wants to show us the unique authority that Jesus has shown in a series of miracles. We have a block, three miracles, then teaching about what it means to follow Jesus, another three miracles, more teaching what it is to be someone who follows Jesus, and then another block of miracles. So as we look at this, if you can follow me in your Bible, we're going to look at the first four verses, healings that point to who Jesus is. So large crowds follow Jesus down the mountainside. They'd heard his teaching in the previous three chapters. And the people have been captivated, astonished by Jesus' teaching. Take a look at verses 28 and 29 of the previous chapter. So that same page, page 972. Let me just read those, 28 and 29. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. When Jesus had finished saying these, the crowds, as I've mentioned, were just astonished at his teaching, amazed, because unlike their own teachers of the law, he had an authority which was unique, which they had not encountered before. Now in verse 2 of chapter 8, the chapter we're looking at, a man with leprosy approaches Jesus, kneels before him, and pleads, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Note how the leper calls Jesus Lord. This man recognizes that Jesus has authority. He also believes that Jesus has power to cleanse him from this disease. Lepers were outcasts in normal Jewish society, kept away and isolated. It's likely that the leprosy we read of in the Bible was a number of skin complaints. Not all of them were contagious, but the main one was. And they were all lumped together, but there were these skin complaints, one of which was particularly contagious. So they were considered in Jewish society as ceremonially unclean. The law stated that they were unclean because they had leprosy. And these purity laws, so called, you can find in Leviticus chapters 13 and 14. We don't need to actually look at those. But essentially, they were a code, they were part of the law which dealt with those who suffered from this particular disease. And they were isolated, kept away from the rest of society to avoid infecting others, amongst other things. And it's a form of quarantine. This man, though, has heard about Jesus somehow and what he's been doing throughout the region. Flick back a few pages to chapter 4, verses 23 to 25. I think it's on page 796. No, it isn't. Thank you. 916, great. All right. So I'll just read them out for you. Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and illness among the people. News about him spread. Then, jumping on to verse 25, large crowds from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and the regions across the Jordan followed him. So he has heard what Jesus has been doing, possibly a family member or a friend who brought food and cared for this man. It would have been at a distance, for he left food, baskets of food for him. Somehow, it's been communicated to this man, the extraordinary things that Jesus is doing. So the leper finds and seeks out Jesus. I mean, that in itself, if you think about it, would have been hard. He'd have been shunned as unclean, but somehow he makes his way and finds Jesus. The leper asks Jesus directly, on his knees, make him clean. Jesus is willing. So how does Jesus respond to this request to make him clean? Jesus reaches out his hand and touched the man. I am willing, be clean. It's not hard to imagine the crowd who are standing around. I guess they would have been distancing themselves from the leper, watching this, and shudder and gasp at what Jesus has just done. He has just touched a leper, someone outside of Jewish society, ceremonially unclean. By touching leper, as I've just mentioned, Jesus has made himself, in the eyes of Jewish law, unclean. But of course, Jesus is no ordinary man. And that's what Jesus is showing us in this account of the healing of the leper. Jesus has the ultimate authority and power over all things, seen and unseen. He is Lord, Lord of all. He's the author of creation. He knows the beginning from the end. And that is what Matthew is pointing out in this healing of the leper. And as we read at the end of verse 3, when Jesus commands the leper to be clean, that's exactly what happens. Immediately, he is cleansed of his leprosy. The goodness, the cleansing power of Jesus restores the man completely. You know what it's like on a cold day when you have a warm drink and you feel the warmth go through your body. It must have been something like that. The goodness, the grace and power would have worked its way through this man. That love and grace, compassion for Lord Jesus as he cleanses and heals completely this man from leprosy. He's free from this appalling disease. Look at verse 4. See that you don't tell anyone. But go, show yourself to a priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them. So why, what lay behind this command? I mean, clearly one factor would have been as the crowds became more and more aware of what Jesus was doing. We all already looked at chapter 4 and saw how he'd been going throughout the region healing. Crowds would have flocked Jesus. Would they understand what he's doing? That compassion and grace which is shown in Jesus, those healings, yet it's pointing to something far more than just the physical healing of people. You see, Jesus, as Matthew's trying to show us in these accounts, is God's chosen king, the anointed one, the Messiah, the one who has authority, fully God and fully man. And if the crowds flocked to Jesus just for the healing, as compassionate as he was and is, the mission to establish this kingdom, this now and not yet kingdom, would well be hindered. Probably though another reason behind Jesus' command to not tell anyone but go straight to the priest lay in the requirements of the Jewish law. For this man to be restored back into his family and society would have to follow the purity laws which I mentioned earlier, which are set out in Leviticus chapters 13 and 14. And the part of the law required someone who'd been cleansed from leprosy to present themselves to the priest or a priest who would examine that person, declare him clean if that was the case, if you like a clean bill of health, and then that person would be able to be restored back into society. But it would also be a witness, a testimony to what Jesus was doing to the authorities, religious leaders, the Pharisees. And more than likely, such a witness, such an account of what Jesus was doing would be unwelcome in such quarters, but a witness nonetheless. And a witness which, if rejected, would condemn those who rejected such clear signs of who Jesus was, why he came, and what he will do. Before we think of what that means for us, I thought we'd look at the next healing miracle, and then we'll consider the two miracles together and just think about what that will mean for us now. So faith from an unexpected person. This is verses 5 through to 13. So in these verses, the authority of Jesus is displayed in a way which is far from expected. Capernaum was a town by the lake of by the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus began his ministry. In verse 5, if you take a look there, a Roman centurion seeking Jesus out finds him. And then when we look at verse 6, see what he says. "Lord," said, "my servant lies at home, paralyzed, suffering terribly." A Roman centurion was a junior officer, commanded 80 men. I'm not sure why it's not 100. Well, I do know why it's not 100 men, but it's too complicated to explain. But he had about 80 men under his command. The Roman officer would have likely been based in Capernaum, more than likely under the control of Herod Antipas, who's the tetrarch of that particular part of Caesarea. And the Roman army was an army of occupation, not much loved by the native Jews. They were there to enforce Roman law, Pax Romana, the Roman peace if you like, but Palestine was a particularly troublesome part of the Roman Empire, and put down any local dissents or uprisings. They would enable taxes to be collected by those Roman subcontracted that role out to. The hated Jewish tax collectors, think of Levi, who would soon be called to follow Jesus, and Zacchaeus, people like that spring to mind. This incident of the Roman centurion asking for his servant to be healed, we also see in Luke's Gospel, chapter 7. And in Luke's account, we get a little bit more detail. Matthew is very, very to the point direct in his accounts of all of these. we find out a little bit more about this Roman centurion. So if you turn to Luke chapter 7, verses 1 to 5, which you should find on page 1035 if you've got a church Bible. If you're using a phone or a tablet, you're on your own, I'm afraid. Let me just read those passages. When Jesus had finished saying all this to the people who were listening, he entered Capernaum. There, a centurion servant, whom his master valued highly, was ill and about to die. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal the servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him, "This man," that's the centurion, "deserves to have you do this, because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue." So Jesus went with them. So it seems that this Roman centurion was interested and sympathetic towards the Jews and Judaism. In fact, as we've just heard from Luke's account, he'd built a synagogue in that particular part of town. So when the centurion makes his request to Jesus, verse 6, he addresses Jesus as Lord, just like the leper addressed Jesus. And although it could be that the word which is translated from Greek in the Bibles we have actually means sir, nonetheless, for a Roman soldier, part of that army of occupation, to address a Jew in this manner just shows that he had an awareness of Jesus' authority. And what's the response? How does Jesus respond? Have a look at verse 7. "Shall I come and heal him?" And what Jesus says here is full of unstated meaning. For a Jew to enter the house of a Gentile was to bring defilement upon themselves. They would, again, be unclean in the eyes of the Jewish law. The Jews considered Gentiles, i.e. anyone who was not Jewish, be unclean, and mixing with them or entering a Gentile's house would be unthinkable. And there's no record in the Gospel of Jesus actually entering a Gentile's house. Yet such is the Roman centurion's recognition of Jesus' authority, he still asked Jesus to heal his servant, come to the house. In reply, the question Jesus posed in verse 7, the centurion's response can be found in verse 8. "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed." The Roman soldier has complete trust, faith. What Jesus commands will happen. This was a man who was used to exercising authority. He controlled, he gave orders to other men, and he expected them to be carried out. His understanding of Jesus' power, in this case over illness, is expressed in terms of absolute authority of a military command. If Jesus says something will happen, or someone will be healed, it will happen. And that's exactly what happened. The centurion's servant would be healed. Have a look at verse 13. "Then Jesus said to the centurion, 'Go, let it be done, just as you believed it would.' And his servant was healed at that moment." But here's another surprising thing. Look at verse 10. Truly, Jesus is amazed. "Truly I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith." There are not many times in the Gospel, if any, when we find Jesus expressing amazement, surprised. Yet the quality of this Roman centurion's faith astonishes Jesus. In chapter 5 of verse 17, that's part of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus tells the crowd, do not think I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to fulfill them. Jesus would fulfill the law in a way that the teachers of the law could not imagine or probably welcome. It was no longer about keeping external rules. It comes through faith in the person Jesus, fully God and fully man. It's through submitting to God's King, hearing the word and putting them into practice. Who can belong to the kingdom? It's not going to depend any longer on external characteristics, such as being a Jew. It comes through inward faith in Jesus, the one who would establish the kingdom, that now and not yet kingdom, the kingdom which will be fulfilled in all its glory, in all its completeness when he returns again. So Jesus gives a warning. Take a look at verses 11 to 12. I say to you, many will come from the east and the west and take their places at a feast with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping, gnashing of teeth. You see, what Jesus is doing is using picture language of that great end time feast, that messianic feast with the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the patriarchs will be joined by a multitude of peoples from around the world. At the same time, his own people, his own kin, Jews, would be excluded if they had not come and put their trust in God's true King, the Anointed One, the Messiah, the ones the Jews had been looking forward to coming. And if they didn't recognize and put their trust, their faith in him, then they would not be part of this picture language which Jesus is using about that messianic, that end time feast, which is looking towards that renewal of all things, that new heaven and new earth. And that covenant promise, if you all the way back in the book of Genesis, the first book of everything, God, the one true God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, he promises to Abraham that his seed, that his descendants will be from all the nations of the earth and be blessed. And that's beginning to be fulfilled now when Jesus comes, as we see here. Faith in him is what enables you to be part of that now and not yet kingdom. Not those external characteristics, not by by obeying external laws. It's by trust in Jesus. And for those who are listening to this, who would have been predominantly Jewish, if not exclusively Jewish, these words would have been shocking. So having looked at these two miracles, healing miracles, had the leper who's been cleansed from leprosy. We now have the Roman centurion's servant who has been healed as soon as Jesus commands him to be healed. What are the implications for us as we look at these now? What can we draw from these for ourselves? You know, I think the challenge for us is to ask ourselves, what does it actually mean to recognize and submit the authority of Jesus? What does it mean to call Jesus Lord and live by that? For many of us, what we've just been looking at, very familiar, I'm sure, well-known miracles that Jesus performed. And possibly that's part of the problem. Matthew's recounts these healings to show that authority and power that belong to Jesus. Yet, do I react in the way the leper does, or the centurion does, in my response to Jesus? They understood who he was, the authority he has, the power he holds. He is all-powerful. He is the author of creation. He rules and reigns, sits at the right hand of the Father. He is gracious and compassionate. I think my danger is, though, I shrink Jesus down into the level of my understanding on so many occasions. Of course, I say the right things. I sing the right things. But, you know, do my thoughts and my emotion, the way I actually live out my day-to-day life, 9 to 5, at work, at home, do they actually line up with maybe what I say, what I sing? Do I pray with that kind of confidence in Jesus' authority and power that the leper and centurion prayed? Second thing I think we can draw from this is that both the leper and the centurion were outside society, that Jewish society in which Jesus had come to establish the kingdom. And also the next miracle, the healing of Peter's mother-in-law, a woman, again, was one who was on the margins of Jewish society. And I guess the question for us is, are there individuals, are there groups of people who we see as beyond or not deserving being part of that kingdom? I mean, when we think about it, social background of people, and in the sort of planting and church planting initiatives, I know that there's been a lot of work planting churches in estates of social housing, areas of deprivation. But actually, I think it cuts both ways. You think, in many ways, as needy as people lacking perhaps some material things, are those who are very affluent. Because increasingly, your dependency is on yourself rather than anyone else. So it's a call, I think, for us to just remember Jesus came as Lord of all. He has authority over all people. And it's a message for all people at all time, whatever your background, your social background, your sexual orientation, your gender, whatever it might be, Jesus, the Lord of all, and he has authority over all people. So that should shape our prayers and our desires as well. Finally, and rather more briefly, we are going to look at verses 14 to 17. Further healings, a further display of who Jesus is, why he came, what he's come to do. So we're looking there, verses 14 to 17. As I mentioned earlier, Capernaum was by the Sea of Galilee, rather the lake, where Jesus seemed to have based himself during his time of his ministry. And it seems to be that he stayed at Peter's house, which had been by the lake. So returning to Peter's house, we see, after these events, Jesus finds Peter's mother-in-law lying in a bed with a fever. Verse 15, he touches her hand. Immediately she's able to get up and begin to serve Jesus. Then in the evening, it seems to be almost like an open surgery, doesn't it? An outdoor surgery. Those possessed by evil spirits are delivered, and those who are ill are healed. And then in verse 17, if you look down at verse 17, Matthew quotes from Isaiah 53, verse 4. Might be a good idea if you turn to Isaiah 53, and I will read verses 4 through to 6. They're well-known passages. It's interesting why Matthew quotes them. So this is Isaiah chapter 53, verse 4 through 6. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted, but he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. By his wounds we are healed. We are all like sheep who have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. This healing of Peter's mother-in-law is also found in Mark and Luke's gospel. Yet neither of these other apostles add this quote from Isaiah. Normally, and I think primarily, what I've just read from Isaiah is about the servant, God's servant, who would come to establish and restore God's kingdom. And it's Jesus. And the passage just read there, often we have it just before Easter, it is about Jesus who came to take the sins of the world upon himself on the cross, the atonement. But Matthew seems to understand the servant's role in Isaiah 53 in terms not just of taking up our sins on the cross, but he absolutely does teach that that is exactly what Jesus did. And we don't need to turn to it, but in Matthew 20, verses 28, just as the Son did not come to be served, but to but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. So Matthew was aware of his sin-bearing death, but it seems to be here that Matthew sees the healing ministry of Jesus just adding a further dimension. Jesus' mission as God's servant, as described in Isaiah. For Matthew, there's no sharp line between the healing of Jesus that he offers and the healing of sin and death which he offered through his own suffering on the cross. So I say, that is the primary understanding of Isaiah 53. Yet Matthew doesn't see a clear, sharp dividing line. Jesus literally took up our infirmities and carried our disease by cleansing the lepers and healing the sick, as we've just seen. And we know that we can bring our requests. We can pray for God to do miraculous things. He could pray for healing. In 1 Peter 5, verse 7, it tells us, cast all your anxieties on him, for he cares for you. But we know that, and as we look around, we know people who suffer and struggle and have prayed. We know that Jesus is compassionate and loving and graceful, and he hears and answers our prayers, perhaps not in the way that we fully understand. And we know that some people have experienced miraculous healing. Can only be an act of God. Yet for many, many others, despite the prayers, they still suffer from a particular ailment or something more serious. But the sickness we all suffer from, that sin sickness, is what Jesus has come ultimately to deal with. And it is through dealing with our sin sickness above all else, but we're made right with God, and we have that promise of belonging to God's kingdom.